Welcome to Libre Lounge, a podcast about free software, free culture, and all the other interesting aspects of user freedom, with Christopher Lemmer-Weber and Serge Roklowski.
All right, welcome to Libre Lounge, a show about software and user freedom. I'm Serge.
I'm Chris.
This time we have a very special guest with us, the president of Software Freedom Conservancy and co-host of the podcast Free as in Freedom, Karen Sandler. Karen, say hi.
Hi there.
So the thing to know about this podcast is that both Chris and I are heavily inspired by Free as in Freedom, podcast that Karen and Brad Lee Kuhn have had going for several years. And Karen is a huge free software advocate and has been for quite a long time, both in her current role as executive director of Software Freedom Conservancy and her past roles in the project. So I thought we would start at the beginning, Karen. What is your background, or how did you get started with free software?
Yeah, well, first I have to correct you because I am not president of the Software Freedom Conservancy. I'm executive director. But I was involved in the founding of the Software Freedom Conservancy. So we'll get to that. But it's actually Bradley Kuhn, who is my co-host on Free as in Freedom, who's the president. So I would be remiss if I didn't just jump in there and claim my correct title.
Good call.
So you asked me how I got involved with free software, right?
Yeah. So I think all of us in free software have a place where we started, kind of an origin story or a thing that motivated us to get involved. So what was that for you?
Yeah, you know, I think that probably the very first thing for me was when I was in college. I went to the Cooper Union. I don't know if either of you have heard of it. It's a very small school in New York City, and it was at the time and will be again someday soon, I hope, free as in charge. it was the only full scholarship university in the United States when I went, and it had financial troubles, but hopefully it will be free again. They're going to start doing more scholarships even next year, so that's pretty exciting. But when I went there as a young engineering student, my very first class was a programming class, and so I went for the very first day of college, and I met a friend in the class, and she and I went to the computer center together. And when we got to the computer center, because, you know, it being, I won't say how many years ago, but a lot of years ago, almost nobody had their own computers. I was actually one of the few people who had their own computers. I had a 286, I believe. And it was like a laptop, but we didn't call it a laptop. I forget what we called it, but
probably a portable.
It wasn't a portable. My father had had one of those portable ones that had the keyboard that was like that clicked onto the front and had a big handle, and it was like 2 feet deep and like a foot high with like a screen that was like, I want to say like 6 inches by 6 inches and like orange and black. But yeah, anyway, so I went with a friend of mine to get my account in the computer center, which is how we would be doing any of our programming for the class. It was like a C and Fortran class, again, showing my age. And it was required for all engineering students. And so she and I went to the computer center and we went to go get our account. And when we walked into the computer center, it was really, really terrible. There were no women there. It was all men. And the stares that we got when we walked into the computer center were really, really uncomfortable. And then there was one guy in the computer center who actually pulled up some ASCII porn on his screen, which was like so offensive.
Yeah, that's really offensive.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, I had have a pretty thick skin. So I was sort of like, whatever. But the woman I was with, she was really upset. And she was like, you know what? I don't need this right now. I'm going to go. I'll come back another time. And she left. And I was like, I'm not leaving. I'm going to stay. So I went into the, I don't know why I did this, but I went into the head of the computer center's office because I was mad and upset that she had left. I thought it was wrong. And so I went in there and I said to him, you have a problem here. You need to do something about this because we just came in for the very first time. And my friend has already left because it was so gross. And he said, you're hired. And I was like, what?
You're hired for what?
I was like, what do you mean? And he said, oh, well, we have computer center operators who help us maintain the computer labs and help people who need assistance. And obviously, I need to hire you. And I was like, well, I've done a little bit of programming, but it's like just in basic and I don't really know very much. And he was like, I'll get my best people to help you learn and you'll learn as quickly as possible. And that's what happened. And that's what I did. It was amazing.
That's really forward thinking of him.
Yeah, it was a great opportunity. And he's a lovely man. He's still at Capri. Bob Hopkins, he was very focused on, and this is the other piece that influenced me in software freedom, is he was very influenced on tech ethics. So he was very involved in a class that they had. There were two mandatory classes for all engineering students at the beginning of the freshman year. One was the programming class and the other, I guess the physics was, there were a bunch of required classes, of course, that had the same curricula across the different engineering disciplines. But another one was like a tech ethics class where we had to study engineering failures over time. And, we studied the Tacoma Narrows, Galloping Gertie. We studied all the ways that tech can fail. And he brought this thing called the Order of the Engineer. Have either of you heard of that?
Is that the thing that has to do with the ring that rubs off on the thing that you work on?
It's this thing where if you see anyone wearing like a ring on their the pinky finger of their working hand, it's engineers that have sworn an oath to be mindful in their work, that their work is that they understand that with great power comes great responsibility, that technologists have special knowledge and that the people who use the product of their work don't have the same knowledge that they do and that lives are at stake. And so the Order of the Engineer was formed in Canada. The ring was an iron ring, and the ring the rings initially were made from iron from a bridge that had failed, so that you always saw it on your working hand. And so it's a Canadian thing and was not very prevalent in the United States. Just one or two universities have done it traditionally. And Bob brought that to Cooper Union. And so I was sworn in to the Order of the Engineer when I graduated from Cooper Union. And it's a cool tradition because in Canadian universities, it's like a really big deal. And so the night before people get sworn in, they do all these pranks, because it's the last time that they're allowed to do, like, to act in any kind of unethical way, because they're going to make their oath. And so it's kind of like, cows up on roofs and things like that happen the night before they get sworn in. So it's pretty fun. And so for me, working in the computer center and getting to know Bob was a really big, big deal for how I became focused on how I thought about software and how I thought about technology. And so for one, it was that I was installing Linux labs in Cooper Union, which I remember thinking, this free software thing is so cool. It's too bad it won't go anywhere. Shows what I know. And then also just being mindful about the fact that there are ethical implications to all of our technology. And so I think those were the two major things that I took away from that experience at Cooper Union. And I think it really, despite the fact that I then went off to go to law school and become a lawyer, I think that those experiences were probably the most profound ones in setting the groundwork for me being passionate about software freedom. And then, of course, later on, after I was already working in the field and thought that open source was really cool, is when I found out that I had a heart condition and got a defibrillator and started being passionate about software freedom.
So let's talk about that. You, I've known you as both a punk rock lawyer and also as a free software cyborg lawyer. And, I'm interested in hearing the transition from, just moving into, like just being, a plain lawyer, or maybe even plain slash, punk lawyer, to getting the free software awareness that came with that other cyborg aspect.
Yeah, so the Punk Rock Lawyer, which is my domain name, it was because I was really into punk rock music. And it was funny because I was working as a corporate lawyer in London and doing like securities law, you know, like debt and equity transactions, mostly debt, and working insane hours. But then I would, and wearing suits a lot of the time. And then I would, like, if I finished work at like 10, I would go see a punk show. And I had the whole thing worked out where I had, at my desk in my drawer, I had my boots. And I would wear like a punk t-shirt under my button down shirt. And I always wore like a skirt suit so that with tights. And then I could just go to the pub across the street from the punk venue. And I was felt like Superman because I would just go into the bathroom and I would like take off the button down shirt and you know, I would leave my coat, my blazer on my desk chair at the office. And then I would just put my hair in like little pigtails and put on a choker and my boots. And I was like wearing almost all the same clothes I'd been wearing all day, but it was like an identity transformation and I was punk rock. And so originally Punk Rock Lawyer was meant to be like a discussion of like, you know, thoughts about identity and how you reconcile these very different identities.
Did anybody at the firm discover your secret identity?
Well, you know, people are people. Like, people are very complex. And when you work with people, you get to know them better. And you really start to like people who are very different from yourselves. And it turns out that, you know, over the years that I work with people, I was not the only one who liked what I thought of as good music. So there was one other person at the firm who was actually in my practice who liked going to similar shows than me, and he would go with me. And then at the end of the day, I think that most of the people who I work with didn't realize that I was doing that. And there was actually one time where I walked by a partner in my law firm on the streets on the weekend, and I was like really decked out, and he just didn't recognize me at all. So he just walked by me.
So we just went from one genre of fiction, which was the which is the superhero genre, and now moving into the science fiction genre. How does it move to the free software cyborg lawyer side of the story?
Oh yeah. So once I'd been working, you know, I have this heart condition, and the process of dealing with my heart condition caused me to completely change the way that I think about the technology that we rely on. And for me, it was deeply personal. And so I have this heart condition where I'm at a very high risk of suddenly dying. I literally have a big heart. It's like three times the size of a normal person's heart. And I'm at a 2-3% chance per year compounding risk of dying. The medical term is sudden death. I kid you not. So I need a defibrillator so that if I go into sudden death, it will shock me and everything will be fine. But in researching this defibrillator and having a technical background and also a legal background, I discovered that that these devices are not particularly safe at all. There's no real security on these devices. The way that these devices are set up are just completely backwards. The software is closed and proprietary, so we can't review it. But at the same time, there's no real security on these devices. So I was pretty horrified when I realized that. I put off for a while getting my device, but I realized that I couldn't put it off because it was just too dangerous for me to live without it. So I got the device thinking that I would work on this in parallel. And that was a while ago. And when I first got this device, I thought the fact that I couldn't see the software in my own body was so terrifying and so upsetting that it really drove me to advocate for software transparency. And it really made me passionate for that aspect of software freedom. But then over the years, as my life progressed and as technology progressed, I had situations where I realized that it wasn't just about software transparency. So when I was pregnant a few years ago, my heart did what a lot of women's hearts do when they're pregnant. About 25% of all women get palpitations when they're pregnant. And because I had a defibrillator, my defibrillator thought that my heart was in a dangerous rhythm, and it shocked me multiple times to fix that. And the only way for me to deal with the situation was for me to take drugs to slow my heart rate down, not because I needed my heart rate slowed down for my heart condition, but solely to prevent unnecessary treatment for my medical device. And it was really tough because I had a hard time walking up a flight of stairs for the rest of the pregnancy.
So you had a hard time running, going upstairs because you had to take medication to slow your heart only because the hardware would shock you otherwise?
Yes, because otherwise there would be a risk that my heart would palpitate at such a speed that my defibrillator would think that my heart was at a dangerous rhythm and it would try to shock me. So the drugs were solely a hack to prevent unnecessary treatment. It was so messed up. And it made me realize that, you know, it's one of those things. Medical device manufacturers have no desire for pregnant women to get shocked. It is literally the last thing they want. Nobody wants pregnant ladies getting shocked and the press nightmare and everything. But when you think about it, only about 40% of the people who get defibrillators are women to start with. And then I found out that only 15% of people who have defibrillators are under the age of 65. So the set of people who are pregnant and have defibrillators is tiny. And I went to a high-risk obstetrician in Roosevelt Hospital, which is now Mount Sinai West, up in the Upper West Side in New York City. And I saw one of the heads of the practice, and this is a woman who is very senior in her career. And I was talking to her about something, and I said, oh, well, the next time you have a defibrillator patient, you might want to know. And she cut me off and she said, oh, I don't have defibrillator patients. I said, what do you mean? And she said, oh, you know, in all of my career, I've had one other defibrillator patient. She said, it happens, but it's just not very common. So, you know, like, I'll take your advice, but I don't anticipate needing it anytime soon. And so it was really interesting because I realized that what was happening to me was not the use case that the manufacturer had anticipated. Through no ill will, they were just not thinking about my situation. And it made me realize, as we're deploying a lot of technology and a lot of software across a very wide range of activities, what haven't the manufacturers anticipated? And I think that over time, we're going to see this come up more and more. And I think that the whole idea terrifies me. And what terrifies me even more is that it took me personally having the experience of being shocked and wrapping my head around it and trying to understand how the device was behaving differently than I needed it to, for me to understand how important it is to have control over the devices that we rely on so that we can fix things when they happen. Now, being pregnant is a temporary condition, but it's a perfect example of the way things can go wrong when the software is put into, you know, when there are cases that are not anticipated in their original design.
That's huge. So help us understand how that transitions to working on conservancy.
Yeah. So right from the beginning of dealing with my defibrillator, and, you know, I was at the time I was a lawyer at the Software Freedom Law Center. So I'd already thought that open source was pretty cool. But then I started to realize that software freedom was really necessary. And I started to engage in a much more direct way. Because for me, it's been such an eye-opening experience. And I realized that my experience is the kind of thing that will help people understand why having control over our critical technology is so important. And so I needed to be more directly involved with the solutions and with the framework to support an alternative through software freedom. And so I've been less on the lawyer side and more on the I was going to say activist, but more on the acting side. So less in a service role, more in a driving role and more of an advocacy role, because I think that it's incredibly important that we have that, that direction. So I've been involved with the Software Freedom Conservancy, actually since its founding in 2006. But I didn't join as an employee until I think it was 2014 when I became executive director, when Bradley hired me to take his job. So
we've mentioned Conservancy a whole bunch of times. So maybe we can take a step back. So what exactly is Conservancy and what does Conservancy do?
Thanks. So Software Freedom Conservancy, we're a U.S.-based charity. So for people who are a little nerdy about that, we're a 501c3 charity. We're an umbrella organization. And so one of the things that we do is fiscal sponsorship. So we have about coming up on 50 free and open source software projects that are a part of us. We are their foundation. So projects that you've heard of like, Git, Sambo, Inkscape, Selenium, Etherpad, Racket. I think because I'm talking to you both, I'm thinking of things that I know you're interested in. We've got a load of these software projects that are they're like analogous to like a division in a corporation. So where they're like their legal form, if they need to sign any contracts or if they need to protect their trademarks or if they have problems with licensing or whatever it is that they, if they want to have a conference or send their send people to other conferences to meet with each other and to work on free and open source software, their problems are our problems. And those are all things that we do. So that's a big, huge chunk of what we do. Some of our member projects are more are kind of meta. So Outreachy is another member project of Conservancy, which Outreachy is a diversity initiative. Maybe we could talk about that a little bit more. We also are, what we're probably most well known for is our GPL compliance work, even though it's a very small portion of the work that we have, that we do. And it's partly because we're a tiny org. We're like, we're just, 4 full-time people and 1 part-time person. And we just are working all the time. So, we just do the best that we can, but GPL enforcement is something that we are perhaps most well known for. And we, helped fund and also supported the lawsuit that Christoph Helwig brought against VMware, which is now in appeal. And so we're a fun organization because while we're a tiny staff, our staff is very high level and low level. Everyone who works at Conservancy is just super passionate about software freedom. Everybody has their own origin story of why they care deeply about software freedom. And they're willing to do all of the high level strategy work, but also the very low level, crummy administrative work. And so we just do everything up and down and it's great. We can work on whatever it is that we think are the most important ethical issues around software freedom. And I think our niche is coming up with really pragmatic solutions that help and also being a real voice for community. And I think that sort of covers the overview of what Conservancy is.
Great. So you mentioned that Conservancy is, you know, kind of a, it's an organization that does a lot with without as many resources as it may appear, given the large amount of things that Conservancy covers. So I would be remiss of me, and I think we'll mention it again at the end, but it would be remiss of me to not point out at this moment that Conservancy is running a fundraiser, that we should all donate to. But in order to get to, before we get into the fundraiser itself, I'd like to actually talk about some of these things that Conservancy is funding in detail, especially because fiscal sponsorship is a great one, because it may appear, especially if you join as a member project, you're like, well, I have my member dues, you know, the member dues is, I think it's 10% of income. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. 10% of the money that our member projects take in go to help support the general funds. But all of our member projects together take in, I think, less than 2 full-time people working at Conservancy, and it takes well more than 4 normal employee hours worth of time to do the work for our member projects. So we have to go out and fundraise to help supplement that.
Right, right. So as you said, it's not enough income on its own, but I'd like to get a sense, you know, if I'm joining as a member project, what does fiscal sponsorship mean? What does it mean to be under Conservancy's umbrella, right? So there's already a hint in terms of fiscal sponsorship of accounting, and holding money, why might I want a separate organization to hold it, right? Like, what if, you know, I could just have all the money transferred to me, the maintainer's bank account, and then I could just distribute that out manually, right? Well, that sounds perfectly fine.
You could do that, but you might have problems if you do that. So for one, you'd have to pay personal taxes on all the money that came in. And secondly, if you paid other people, you'd have to deal with the tax implications of that too. But perhaps even more importantly is that there's a trust aspect to it, which is that you might be a trusted member of the community today, but it's hard to predict what's going to happen tomorrow. Using a fiscal sponsor or an organization like Conservancy, or there are others in the field too, there are quite a few really good organizations that are all a little bit different. But using one of us means that there's assurance that whatever money comes in is going to be handled properly. It won't be, misused in any way, whether accidentally or intentionally. And we've had both happen in our field, where folks have absconded with money in a not great way. But more often, we just have people who get busy with something else, or their interests change, and then it's hard to get a hold of them. And then the money or whatever other assets are there basically just get tied up, and it's very difficult to figure out how to get access to them. If you're a part of Conservancy or another charitable fiscal sponsor, then there's a tax deduction in the U.S. if to the extent that it works for your tax situation. So, like, there are quite a few advantages to being with Conservancy. Plus, also, if you're ever applying for grants, or there are a whole host of other reasons why coming into something like Conservancy is valuable. The other thing is, you don't know what problems are coming up down the road, and we have a lot of synergy. Oh, I said synergy, but yeah, we have a lot of synergy amongst our member projects, because they often have similar kinds of problems, and so we can tackle them for everybody at the same time. And we like do things like negotiate, like, you know, donated services from companies and things like that. You know, like
so,
credits from Gandhi for domain names, and we've gotten server credits and things like that, and it benefits all of our member projects.
So if I'm putting my money into Conservancy, and I don't imagine everybody does this, but I maybe I'd so it's actually impressive to me that in many ways that, you know, Conservancy is actually doing, you know, running the books, but I may also want to be able to see that myself. Is there a way for that to become transparent to me as a maintainer of the project, as a community steward of my own project?
Oh my gosh,
this
is one of the things I'm most proud of about Conservancy. So we keep the books and records for our member projects, but we keep them in a Subversion repository, despite the fact that Subversion is not a member project of Conservancy, but Git and Mercurial and Darks all are. but we use Subversion is really good for this kind of thing. So we keep our books and records in Subversion, and then each member project has access to their own repository, and so they can generate their own reports on their own books and records, and they can scrutinize particular transactions if they want. We've been working really hard to try to work on an accounting system that is very accountable, that's very transparent, and that also generates the right kind of reports that we want to. It's very, very difficult to keep good books and records for so many restricted accounts. I mean, we've got, you know, almost 50 member projects, and so we have to keep books and records for all of them. And that's pretty tough. So we're really proud of it. We actually recently went to our auditors. I personally went to our auditors to hand them our books and records for the year. Now that we're at the end of the year, and we have a deadline next month to file our annual report with the IRS. And so I brought the USB drive over to them with our books, and the accountant, who is the main contact, was working with a new junior person, and he was like, "Hey, you gotta look at these books and records." And he like called over the junior guy and asked him to put the drive in to take a look at it. And the junior guy was blown away. He was like, "Oh my gosh, everything's here!" Because we have like links in our main ledger to our receipts and to our everything is like, because it's accounting as designed by nerds, and it is awesome.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I'm familiar. You're using the Ledger program by John Weigley, right?
We are. Currently. We're transitioning, I believe, to Bean Count now.
Okay, cool. Which is also similar in plain text accounting, mm-hmm. You see. Cool. So there may be other things. So if I'm a member project, you mentioned some other things that there may be details. Like, what what is it? You hinted at like trademarks and maybe licensing things. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, so we do. I mean, just whenever our member projects have problems, there are problems. So I'm a lawyer, but I usually am acting as executive director. But we have a lawyer on retainer, and there are often problems where folks have all manner of legal questions. The most common thing is related to trademark. So we file for the trademarks of our member projects, and we defend them. And that you'd be surprised how often that comes up, and how often free software projects are under threat trademark wise. And we sometimes it's we help Git, for example, enter into agreements with the companies that have used the name Git following them, and then we've made sure that there's a limit to how many Git names there are out there, because it can be very confusing, some of the names that folks have come up with. And so you can see I know that you all are awesome and have great show notes, so I'll try to get you a link to the email that we helped Git write, where they explained how they enforce their trademark and why. And so you can see, get a flavor of the kind of thing that we do. We just work with projects to design like legal solutions together that really work. And we always have great counsel. We've got we've got a few lawyers that we pay and a few lawyers that are just volunteers. And it's just a really great legal staff that helps us. So I'm pretty proud of that.
So that's a great transition. So you've talked about what Conservancy does in terms of helping organizations take money in, and you mentioned earlier GPL enforcement. So how exactly does the license enforcement work? Let's break that down a little bit. So if someone is violating a software license, you're going to come in, I guess, representing that organization. So does that mean that you're now the copyright holder, or how does that
work? So there are two
different
ways that we wind up doing GPL enforcement. One is as like an enforcement agent, and one is as a copyright holder. So it sort of depends how it works. So we have our member projects that want to enforce this. So not, our member projects, we as an organization are license agnostic. So we have projects that have lax permissive licensing, and we have projects that are strong copyleft, and we have everything in the middle. We don't require that our projects be copyleft. Quite the contrary, we just support whatever it is that they decide to do. But for our projects that are copylefted, those that choose to enforce their copyrights, we help them do so. And that either takes the form of them just asking us to help them as an enforcement agent, or it comes in the form of them assigning their copyrights to us. And we haven't pushed either way. People tend to have really strong feelings about what they would prefer, and so we just support whatever it is that folks want. What we're probably most well known for is enforcing the GPL on behalf of Linux kernel developers who have asked us to do so. And we have a mix there too. Some have, we've had copyrights assigned to us, and we also have just act as an assistant to copyright holders. So it kind of runs the gamut.
So let's talk about that. I want to talk about the particular case that you mentioned. But before we do that, in most cases, my understanding is that it doesn't have to go to court like it has in the GPL case. But maybe you can.
Yeah,
talk about
I mean,
that.
So we try really hard to do our enforcement in a principled and ethical way. So we're a charity, and we are focused on supporting software freedom for the public good. But we recognize that the only way that software freedom will succeed in the long run is if companies are involved with free and open source software, and there's free software in the devices that we're relying on. So when we enforce, our attitude is that someone who is violating the license today is tomorrow's contributor. And so we wanted to set the ground rules so that when we contact people, they know what they can expect from us. And so we've put down these principles for community-oriented GPL enforcement up, and there are things like compliance is our primary goal, not money. And that we're not shaking people down for money based on silly violations. We also had the idea that what we would do is we would even though most of the enforcement we do, not all of it, but most of it is on GPLv2, that we allow companies to have a little bit better, we treat them as if they had GPLv3 termination provisions, which means that that there's a cure period. So if you're in a violation under GPLv2, you automatically lose your rights. And the only way you have a right to distribute is if your rights are restored. Whereas under GPLv3, there's a period of time where if you fix that problem, then you automatically are able to distribute again. I don't know. Is this too in the weeds?
No, I think it's good. I think we want to stop a little bit and focus, I guess, on the specific, right? So the case that everyone who is in the know talks about in here is VMware. So maybe you can talk
totally.
A little
I'll
bit about that
I'll wrap up the principles to say that I'm really excited that it looks like bits of the principles are being adopted. They wholesale were endorsed by some other entities like GPLviolations.org. But Red Hat has started doing this thing called the GPL cooperation commitment, and that's been adopted, and that basically adopts just that termination provision. But I really hope that people take a look at the principles overall and embrace them more fully, as a litigation is a last resort. And so that's sort of the way that we do it. It sometimes takes a long time, but then we're confident that we're not increasing the risk for companies to adopt free and open source software. It's a really difficult line to walk, and we do the best that we can. So VMware has been our most, I think, prominent case, and it's been going on now for years. Christoph Hellwig, I think Conservancy was working on that for a few years already before Christoph filed his lawsuit against VMware. Christoph Hellwig is a part of our coalition, but he filed the suit directly in Germany. And we funded the suit and also provide support where we can. And now the case is on appeal. There was recently a hearing. And so I think there'll be more news about that in the coming year.
All right. So we want to keep talking about all the cool things you're doing in Conservancy, but I want to kind of follow up to something you had said earlier about contracting. And I don't remember if you explicitly mentioned this, but the idea that Conservancy can pay for development, or can be a means by which developers can get paid.
I'm just going to say, I'm going to break the wall a little bit to say that Chris and Serge are so cool. We've recorded this. This is like the third time we've tried to record this podcast, because we had audio difficulties the first two times, and they're just amazing. And so this is sort of referencing back to, we did a take that wasn't usable, and we were talking about this. And I just wanted to take this moment to just say that I'm so excited that they're doing this podcast, and you're just both really so nice. So thank you so much.
Well, we're excited to be doing this podcast with you, especially because of all the critical things that Conservancy is doing. So yeah, I'm also interested in the way that Conservancy being able to be paid for, doing things as contracting. And actually there's a number of ways in which that ties in a certain sense. Actually, there's another contracting thing that you've had recently, which is this contract patch.
That's right.
Initiative.
So we have so one of the things that we do for our member projects is that we will hire developers or other contributors to free and open source software. And so we have quite a few member projects that choose to do that. Some really successfully. Godot is a really good example of that. They have a few really amazing developers that are contracting to help make Godot better. And it's just really transforming they're excellent. And we have quite a few member projects that are in that category, where we're paying developers to work on stuff. So I think including the outreach interns, it's always quite a lot of people that we pay per year. It's often over 100. So we're there. So that's one of the things that we do. And then the other thing that Chris is referring to is that we have been starting to work on this thing where we realize that there's an inequity that often happens in the relationship between free software contributors and the companies that are very involved in this space. And where a lot of free and open source software projects had started out as hobbyist projects back in the day, before companies had been very involved in free and open source software, the individuals that were involved had a tremendous amount of power about the fate of the project. But over time, what has happened is that companies have gotten involved, which is great. But in order to help companies participate more, we've given up so very much to them and ceded a lot of control in free and open source software. And one of the things that we've seen is that the move away from copyleft towards lax permissive software means that that there's even less power from on behalf of the community. And one of the things that kind of balances this is having a distributed copyright holding. So if you have a project and the copyrights are not aggregated with a company, but instead are held by a lot of people, it becomes a lot harder for companies to shift away, to pivot away to other licensing, which we're seeing a lot in a lot of different areas right now. We're seeing new licenses. We're seeing non-free licenses come out of companies who had aggregated copyrights under the guise of, or the name of being a good steward. But now in order to make sure that they have a business model that is interesting to their VC investors or that they feel like they can maximize their profit in a particular way, they're pivoting away from free licensing. And if we don't allow companies to aggregate our copyrights, if we hold them more distributedly, then it means that we have a lot more control over making sure that the projects stay free and also that they are in a direction that we want. So one of the things that we've done is to help empower developers to negotiate their employment agreements a little bit better. So for example, if you're hired to work on, work at a job and they tell you you're going to work only on free and open source software, then why not put that in agreement? If you're working on copylefted software in particular, why not ask to hold the copyrights to the software that you're contributing to? I think a lot of people don't realize that they can negotiate their employment agreement, but in fact, quite often you can. And so I actually taught a continuing legal education class last year, it was like a year and a half ago, to a whole room of lawyers. And I asked how many of them had been asked to modify their company, one of their clients, a company's employment agreement to accommodate requests that developers had made, either to accommodate something that supported software freedom. And 2/3 of them had raised their hands. So this is something that is very, very doable. And so one of the things that we're doing is we're bringing together standard contract language so that folks can have the tools to ask, let's patch the contract in this way or that way. So we called the initiative Contract Patch. And we started out by publishing a couple of blog posts that are basically like, yes, you can negotiate your employment agreement. And here are all the things that you can think about. And we're still working on it. We're really low on resources, but this is one of the things that I think is pretty exciting that we're doing.
And it can be, I think so in a certain sense, actually talking about these types of things can make a big difference as well, right? So actually, I am a person who in my last employer negotiation, I actually asked for such a provision, and I probably wouldn't have done it if it weren't for the Contract Patch Initiative, because to be honest, I'm kind of a shy and feel like I'm imposing all the time person. And it can feel like, oh, I don't really want to be that person, like capital T, capital T, that person type thing. So it feels to me like hearing that kind of thing, like, no, it's okay, can actually kind of give permission and space to be able to do those types of things.
Studies show that when you negotiate your employment agreement, that your employer actually respects you more. Now, there are some caveats to this, which is that studies also show that people are not treated the same way when they ask for the same things. So, for example, women and minorities, studies show that when they ask aggressively for things, that might not be interpreted exactly the same way. But across the board, it pretty much never hurts to ask. And there are nice ways to ask to modify your contract. There's, you can ask in a very non-threatening way. There are times when first of all, you should always negotiate for money. You should always ask for more money than they've offered you, because normally they have a range that they're expecting to pay you, and they offer you the lowest part of that range. And they are expecting, when they offer you the range, that you will ask for more and that they'll wind up in the like a little bit higher than what they offered you. So by not asking to negotiate your contract at all, you're just leaving money on the table. And it's similar with these contract provisions, is that sometimes if you ask for a lot of things, they'll just give you these contract provisions because it's not money, or it's not a, you know, a title they can give you or something. And so it's like kind of a balancing act. And so it, you always should ask. It never hurts to ask. And you can say things like, you know, I've been told that I really should ask. I usually say, in these situations, like if I'm negotiating something, like for example, when I'm asked to speak a lot, and I read a study that said that women don't ask for honorariums, so I always just say, I'm just very straightforward. I say, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to come speak at your event because I think it's important, but I am aware that women don't ask for honorariums and men do. So if you have an honorarium, I would like to request it, and I would like to request the biggest budget that you have for that honorarium. And do you know, one time Conservancy got a $10,000 honorarium because of that. Yeah, I didn't even think there was going to be anyone. Wow. But you know, it's That's the same great. Thing with employment contracts. You just may as well you may as well ask.
Well, that ties in to a certain extent with you. So you're talking about the ways in which people are perceived, and also, you know, taking an active effort to be able to, especially with an awareness of the social context in which these kind of differences do exist in our society. That feels like it ties in directly to me with the next piece that we wanted to talk to you about, which is outreachy. Probably a lot of our listeners know what outreachy is, but I'd love to hear you describe it in your own words.
So, outreachy is a diversity initiative. It's paid remote internships for folks that are either underrepresented or experience systemic bias. And we have about usually around 90 interns per year, and they're with a variety of different free and open source software projects, from the Linux kernel to Wikimedia to GNOME and Debian, OpenStack. There's a ton of projects that participate, and it follows Summer of Code. It's inspired by Summer of Code because the project, the program originally started out at GNOME. And GNOME participated in Google Summer of Code, and there was one summer where they had 181 applicants for GNOME, and only and no women were part of that. And so it was an effort to try to fix some of the problems that we have. And the program, as it's running now, was started in 2009, and just before I came in as executive director at GNOME. And when I came in, we expanded the program to include other free and open source software projects. Actually, I was a volunteer at Conservancy at the time. So Conservancy was the first entity that joined GNOME in outreachy as a, or it was outreach program for women at the time, but in outreachy as an experiment. So I'm actually really proud of that. Now I get to work at Conservancy, and then ultimately, because the program wasn't just for GNOME, GNOME and Conservancy agreed that that Conservancy was a better fiscal home for outreachy. So now outreachy is within Conservancy too. So it's pretty exciting program. More than 500 people have come through the program already, and we haven't, like, we don't formally collect metrics, but anecdotally we do, and our non-metric metrics are awesome. So like about 100 people who have come through the program have now given full length talks at tech conferences, which is pretty cool. A ton of people found employment after in something that's connected to free and open source software. We have people in amazing leadership positions. So one of the graduates founded the Nairobi Developer School, and Women in Free Software, Women in Free Software India, and Chris is familiar with, there's a Chicago hacking group that that one of the graduates was involved in starting. And so, like, graduates are on the boards of organizations and are really shaping the leadership of those projects. And so I'm pretty proud to be involved with outreachy.
That's great. I actually remember when the original GNOME women's server of code. I don't remember what the original name was, but I remember when it came out. And I remember seeing the post where they said, you know, here there were all these submissions and they were only men. And then we explicitly asked, and there were more women that submitted than there were in the original the first not asking for women Summer of Code round. Is that correct? I seem to remember it being a higher number than the original thing even
yeah,
had.
Yeah, I mean, it turns out that that expressly inviting certain groups to participate is huge. So there have been quite a few graduates of Outreachy over the years. And I just call it Outreachy, even though it was originally Women's Outreach Program, then it was Outreach Program for Women, and now it's Outreachy. You know, it's been an evolution over time. But early on, especially, there were people were very explicit that they were too intimidated to apply to Summer of Code. And because the program expressly invited women, they felt like they could do it. And quite a number of people came through Outreachy and then did Google Summer of Code. And what's cool is that I think that we helped Google Summer of Code a little bit, because some of our applicants came from, you know, went from Outreachy to Summer of Code. Plus also, you know, some of our graduates become mentors. Actually, one of the cool stories is that there was a more than one participant now has not only become just a mentor, but their mentee has become a mentor. So we have former participants who are now grand mentors.
Awesome. And so I just wanted to clarify, one of the changes I think that happened in the move from Outreach Program for Women to Outreachy is that it's not just for women specifically. There are some other groups that it covers as well.
That's right. It's for folks that are underrepresented and also who have experienced systemic bias. And we expressly invite women and non-binary people. And also we expressly invite racial along the lines of racial diversity. So we expressly invite people who are based in the United States and who are in groups that are underrepresented in U.S. tech. And we explicitly list those so that people can recognize if they fit in it, and then they can apply to our program.
Great. So I actually, in a certain sense, it kind of feels like you're kind of full circle back towards the lab.
I know, it's so funny. And you know what's interesting is that despite the fact that it happened to me where I got a real opportunity because I wasn't asking for any diversity initiative when I went into that the head of the computer center's office. I really wasn't. And all I was asking for was that they sort of do a better job at influencing the atmosphere to be less icky. That was what I really wanted. I wasn't asking for anything more than that. And I was a little surprised that it resulted in that job. And I tell you, I was a little uncomfortable with it. And I was very adamantly against diversity initiatives when I was in college and right after that for a while. I thought that if I talked about how bad it was for women in tech, that we would draw attention to the problem, and that it wouldn't help anybody, and that the only way that we were going to fix the problem was that if the women who were already in tech were so awesome that no one would ever question whether women belong there again. But of course, what happened was over that time, I saw that the stats on women in tech actually got worse and worse. In the 80s, which was before my time, but in the 80s, about a third of the women in computer science degrees were women. And then quite recently, it's been more like 18%. And so it's just been generally dropping. And then the stats with free and open source software, even worse. About 25% of all software developers are women across proprietary software and free software, just across the board. But with free and open source software, it's anywhere from like 1 to 4%. The very best study, the most represented survey I've ever seen, was 11%. So we're doing like way worse than the rest of tech. So yeah, so it's really funny that it's kind of it's a like a complete circle around to where I started, except that the lessons that I've taken from that experience at Cooper Union are different than the ones that I had at the time, because it's funny how you have to live a lot of this discrimination firsthand. You have to have all these bad experiences, the the jerk who licked my neck at OSCON, the, you know, the guy who followed me to my hotel room, like the many people who assumed that I was a spouse or significant other and could not have been a speaker. The many people who assumed that I was a marketer and not involved in that I had no idea, despite the fact that I was at a free software conference, that I had any idea what free software was. The fact that when I hang out with other executive directors of orgs that are men and a technical issue comes up, they explain the issue to me, even though the similar person next to me, who's executive director of another like free and open source software entity, you know, this has happened to me before, but there's one in particular who had been a marketer. Like, he had no tech background. And, you know, like, you know, once upon a time, I was programming in C and Fortran and Lisp. And, you know, like, the presumption that I am not technical. And I tell you, over the years, I just realized if I were not already established, if I didn't have my heart condition, I was so passionate about software freedom, I would just have given up. It's so much work. It's, like, always so much work to prove yourself. There's studies that show that this this happens pretty uniformly. There was a study that showed that if you showed patches, if you had people review submitted patches, and you identified a gender with the submission, that folks, the reviewers, considered the submissions by women to be inferior to those of men. But if you anonymize them actually, then the submissions by women were considered of higher quality. And so it's just constantly having to work to work that much harder, to be that much better, to be considered as good as a mediocre man. So
let's talk about that a little bit in terms of the benefits. So before we do that, it's obvious from what you've said, from what many of others have said, that women are vastly underrepresented in free software. The question that keeps coming up in these male-dominated circles is, well, why is that important? Why do we need diversity? Why do we need women? Why do we need people of color in free software? And with your work in outreach,
there are a number of answers to that. I mean, I like to stick to statistics as much as I can and to demonstrate, like that study that I just told you about. But we need diverse perspectives in our technology, or we're not going to succeed. One example of this that I like to talk about is there are actually multiple soap dispensers on them that have been brought to market that work great for white hands. But if someone with dark hands tries to use the soap dispenser, it just doesn't work. And there are hilarious videos where people put their hands under the soap dispenser and nothing happens, but then they take a paper towel and a white paper towel and it works. And it's totally obvious that whoever designed those soap dispensers, you know, of course they wanted anyone who was approaching the soap dispenser to get soap out of their dispenser. That was the whole point of designing a soap dispenser. But they clearly had no darker hands on their team, or they would have recognized right away that their soap dispenser didn't work for darker hands. And this is exactly an example of the kinds of things that will happen to our technology if we don't have diverse people working, if we don't have a diverse set of people working on our software. We don't even, like my defibrillator situation, right? The set of people who are pregnant with defibrillators is tiny, like, but having any women at all on the team would possibly change the way that folks would design their products, even from the get-go. And there's like a laundry list of anecdotes that have come out of industry of products that have, you know, have been not very easy for women to use simply because there were obviously no women involved in their team. So, you know, I think it's really important if we want free and open source software to be successful, we have to have a diverse set of people working on that software.
Well, I think you're touching on an important issue, which is the question of whether or not free software is meaningful because it gives us user freedom, meaning the people who wrote it, or whether we're trying to make everyone free. So in your example, you know, things that help women wouldn't necessarily help me directly, right? Because I'm a cis man. So what I'm really asking is, this is a loaded question, right? So how does more users of more types help us
as
a movement?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think that this is sort of really cuts to the heart of the different theories around why software freedom is important. I believe very strongly that software freedom is about user freedom. I've been talking a lot to Molly DeBlanc about this recently, and she and I gave a couple of talks together, one at HOPE and one at DebConf, about software freedom and user freedom. I think that I became passionate about software freedom because of my defibrillator. That's one hell of a printer story. I think Stallman probably had his printer story and he took away the frustration that he was unable to fix his own printer. That is about user freedom, even though it's freedom to personally develop your software. For me, when you start talking about medical devices, yes, I am technical, but what I really want is the ability to hire whatever medical professionals that I want to make sure that my medical devices are right for me. And so for me, the whole point of software freedom has to be a societal one. There has to be something fundamental about user freedom. And the way that we're building all this critical technology right now, it also has something to do with, do we even understand the technology we're using? Can we consent to it? And if we have no control, then what does that mean for our ultimate destiny? What are we going to be able to do when things go wrong? That is the main question. And if we're stuck with particular companies, if we're locked in, we're going to be totally screwed. There's this thing called the honeymoon effect, where researchers have shown that while the number of bugs in a software project goes down over time, the number of vulnerabilities upon a product launch is flat. And there's like this honeymoon period where it takes time to, it takes time for there to be vulnerabilities that are known about. But once one happens, it increases almost exponentially. And the length of that honeymoon period is completely undefined. And it's different from project to project. They looked at free software, but they also looked at proprietary systems as well. And what that tells me is that we don't have to worry about the security of the devices today or right at product launch when the relationships are good, when the developers who created the products are in the companies. We need to worry about it down the road, whether it's in 6 months or 10 years. My defibrillator is theoretically going to last 17 years. The rep told me that was very possible. What will things be like in 17 years? Will the company still be in business? If they are in business, will they have any relationships with the vendors that sold them their source code? So these are things that we really have to think about. And having complete and corresponding source code along with the scripts to control installation, to borrow a phrase from the GPL, is the most critical thing.
That makes a lot of sense. So let's talk a little bit about the podcast, or I guess in your case, the Ogcast that inspired this one, which is Free as in Freedom. Can you talk a little about the origin of that Ogcast, where it is now? Talk a little bit about the differences. I guess the biggest difference in my mind between what you guys did and what we're doing is that this is a more casual conversation. I think Free as in Freedom was a more policy-oriented. And from that end, I don't want to say technical in the technology sense, but technical in that you guys dive deep into the woods of a lot of these issues, which is great. I mean, it's an amazing resource.
Yeah, you're
so
one of the three
listeners,
I think.
Can you talk a little about Free as in Freedom?
Which is a joke. We have a badge of pride because someone once told us that someone once recognized my voice and said, oh, you're one of the three. I thought I recognized you. You're one of the voices of that. You're one of the people who hosts that Ogcast that three people listen to. And so we told that story on our Ogcast, and then it became a badge of pride and people started saying, I'm one of the three. And it was really fun. So we even got where somebody wrote me and said, I'm one of the three listeners that I know in Sri Lanka. So, super fun. Free as in Freedom has been really fun. We've been on hiatus, but we promised to come back in 2018. And while it is getting very close to the end of 2018, we are committed to keeping our promise. So I think we'll be coming back on that soon.
All right. Well, I think your faithful listeners will be waiting for that. So is there anything else before we wrap up that you want to touch on that we haven't? Or Chris? Actually, Chris, is there anything you want to bring up?
Well, okay. I'm interested in general shout-outs, in case you have any general shout-outs. But then I want to get back to I want to say a little bit more about the fundraiser. So before we get to saying a few more words about the fundraiser, Karen, do you have any shout-outs that you want the audience to hear?
I'm going to shout-out to both episode? Of you, because you're awesome. I think... I don't know. I haven't prepared any shout outs, but there are so many awesome people and organizations working in free and open source software that I'm a little flummoxed and trust that you will be interviewing many of those important people over the course of your show as it develops.
Great. Yes, we definitely hope to interview more people, including more people from Conservancy. That's definitely our hope. But let's get back to the fundraiser. I want to wrap up on that because it's no coincidence that we pulled you on now because we wanted to, although we're very excited to have, well, in some ways I can't believe we have Free as in Freedom co-host Karen as our first guest on this podcast. Like that's an amazing thing for me personally, being the huge Free as in Freedom fan that I am. But we did want to pull you on here to talk about the fundraiser. And so I just wanted to say, to me, it feels like everything that you've been talking about does kind of pull to mind the image of, you know, Conservancy's little tree logo, the idea of Conservancy really being a Conservancy, really being a steward of the commons. Because it feels to me like, you know, like a garden, free software needs tending hands. Otherwise, else, you know, we can't really grow. And I, and to me, that feels like why it's really important to donate to Conservancy at this time, and why I will be. So I'm curious if you have any comments about that, or about the state of the fundraiser, and or any wrap up words that you want to say before people hopefully join Serge and I in putting their donations
to good purpose. I'm totally going to be honest with you and say I'm a little nervous because it's the biggest match we've ever tried to do the last few years. We've been super lucky, and private internet access has given us $50,000 as a match donation, and then we have an individual who has topped that off with $25,000, and so we've done $75,000, and we've been able to get that every year, and I think it gets people excited. And it always makes me a little nervous because having a donation that you don't know if you're going to get if people don't step up is stressful. But it's cool, and I think people understand that their donation is that much more impactful when it's matched like that, and that's really cool. But this year, Molly DeBlanc, who I mentioned earlier, she got a group of people together to increase the amount by yet another $15,000. And so these are not super rich individuals; these are just people who care about software freedom, and they care about Conservancy, and they like what we're doing. And so they've been able to personally put their, you know, what they can afford in and step up and say that they want to invite people to donate, and that they will personally match whatever small amount they can. And so it's been really cool and exciting, but at the same time, it's a much bigger amount than we've ever done before. And so please, 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 if you're listening, please think about donating. Once we realized that standing up for the GPL and doing the VMware lawsuit and doing all the other work that we do in the community interest and prioritizing that and not letting companies influence us, we saw a diminishment in corporate funding that we had. And so we had to pivot to an individual donor model. And what's so awesome about that is that everything we do, we think about, will that encourage people to give us $120 or more per year? Like, will it inspire someone to give us $10 a month? And that keeps our motivations perfectly aligned with where they should be. And I really love that. So things like how our work on the DMCA exemptions for smart TVs, and then personally I did the medical devices stuff too, all that stuff, everything we do, we're looking for maximizing the impact for software freedom in the community. We're friendly with companies, and we do have many companies that sponsor us, but it's our lifeblood are our individuals, and it has to stay that way for us to be a successful organization.
Well, great. I think that, so we covered a lot of things that Conservancy does in this episode, and we didn't even go through all of the many projects that Conservancy covers. So I am going to make a bold assertion here, which is that you cannot get a better bang for your buck than donating to Conservancy as in terms of advancing user freedom. So I'm going to donate tonight after I get off this episode. Serge, I believe you're donating as well, correct?
Yeah, I am a member of Conservancy.
Great. So we are excited to donate. And,
if you love this, if you love this podcast, you will be a member as well.
Yes. So we, Karen, we are so thrilled to have you on as our first guest.
And grateful. We're grateful
and,
to have you
and
on.
Grateful. You know, both as, you know, the for all the work you do and also for the incredible person you are. And
I'm really grateful for all
thank
of your
you for
work,
joining
and
us
I'm
here.
I'm thrilled to
on
have
Libre
been
Lounge.
The first guest. Thanks to everyone for listening.
Thank you. And we hope to hear you in the future. Thanks for coming and joining us. And we will talk to you guys next time.
Take care.
You've been listening to Libre Lounge. You can find and subscribe to us at LibreLounge.org. This podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 4.0 International License. Our theme music is Bossa Nova by Joth, which is waived into the public domain under CC0 and which you can find on OpenGameArt.org. If you'd like to support Chris Weber's work on this and other user freedom projects, you can donate at patreon.com/CWEBBER. Thanks for listening. See you next time.